You don't know what.
Good morning, everyone. We are going to start today with a report that was required by a law that we passed in 2015, Senate Bill 61. Paul Warner is going to take the stand, as it were, and fill us in on the body of the report, and then we'll go into a public hearing on Senate Bill 155. Dr. Warner.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. Back in 2015, when you passed Senate Bill 61, I did cause quite a stir with the military department because I listed Senate Bill 61, and I got a call and said, "That's our most important bill." I said, "No, no, not 2017, 2015. So what that bill did was a number of things. So it did modify the list of jurisdictions, and this is that was initially discussed with the Department of Revenue's biennial report. It then also gave some additional flexibility to the Department of Revenue for those situations where the apportionment results were not deemed to accurately reflect or be fair of what the apportionment should be. And I'll talk a little bit about that, too, in some examples. But it also directed the Legislative Revenue Office to prepare a report containing, quote, an assessment of the cost effectiveness of the state's policy governing the tax treatment of corporations incorporated in offshore jurisdictions. So that's what this report is, to try to address that issue and what the effectiveness is. First thing I thought I would do with the committee is just walk through some examples to remind you of how the mechanics work in terms of the current law. As you recall, the way it works is that if a member of a unitary group, of a corporate filing group, has income reported in one of these listed jurisdictions, and the list is back in the appendix of this report, you can see the current list and what recommendations from Department of Revenue are. But if there's income reported in one of those listed jurisdictions, it is to be included on your corporate return. And so we now have 1 year of data, and I'll go talk about that and what that shows. But first of all, just to remind you how it works, Oregon is a water's edge state. We start our corporate income tax calculations with the water's edge or national level of income. And that's the first line there in the table. It's my example here for corporate return A. They're reporting $95 billion in sales. They have net income of $5 billion, and Oregon sales are $4,750,000. So when we look at the amount of income to be apportioned back to Oregon, it's going to be the sales factor that drives that amount. So if you take the $4,750,000 and divide it by the $95, you have a sales factor, a sales share of 5%. So 5% of net income will come back to Oregon. In this example, that's $250 million. Applying our tax rates, the Oregon tax bill would be about $19 million. So that's the way the law worked prior to 2013. So no further adjustments to that based on water's edge. Now, including the changes beginning in 2013 and including the list of jurisdictions, in my example here, corporate return A doesn't have any sales in that listed jurisdiction, but it has net income of $1 billion. So the way it works on their tax return, they have to report that $1 billion to the Department of Revenue. And that means that instead of having net income of $5 billion, they have net income of $6 billion. And since there's no sales in the jurisdiction, the sales factor for Oregon remains the same. So what that means is instead of 5% of $5 billion, which is $250 million, it's 5% of $6 billion, which is $300 million. And you can see how it falls through to income apportioned to Oregon there is $300 million in this case. So applying the tax rates, this corporation has a tax bill of $22.8 million or an increase of $3.8 million because of the income reported in the listed jurisdiction. So that's the way it's designed to work. It works in combination with our apportionment formula. Now, the second example I have here is all the same, except that we have the $1 billion reported in the listed jurisdiction, and the Corporation B is able to document that they have $500 million of that income reported in the listed jurisdiction that didn't result from the activities of U.S. affiliates. In other words, was income that was really generated in a non-U.S. in another country and not the U.S. So it gets back to kind of your policy goal of including this income, is that the water's edge calculation is not an accurate reflection of what the tax base should be. So that's the theory, the policy behind adding those listed jurisdiction income. So in this case, the $500 million would not be included in income, so it would be $5.5 billion instead of $6 billion, as it was in example A. So your income apportioned is $275 million, and your tax bill is 20.9 for an increase of 1.9 instead of the 3.8 in our previous example. And then the last case, example 3 here is all the same as example 2. The difference is that in this case, our corporate filing group C has sales in the listed jurisdiction. It has activity in that jurisdiction. So the result of that is that has to be included in the denominator. So now you're dividing Oregon sales by a bigger number, and so you get a smaller sales share for Oregon. And instead of being 5%, adding this extra $5 billion into sales lowers Oregon's apportionment to 4.8%. So you still have the $5.5 billion to apportion, but it's apportioned by 4.8% instead of 5%. Result is a tax bill of $19.9 million, which is a million more than previous law, but about almost a million less than it would have been without those sales in the listed jurisdiction. So that's the way the system works. It's important to recognize that we're including this income on the returns, but everything still is determined by the apportionment factor. So whatever influences the amount apportioned will affect the tax bill, and potentially the apportionment factor if there's sales in the listed jurisdiction. So the next thing on the report is to look at kind of the question that you directed us to answer, and that was the cost effectiveness. And what we did was look at it from two perspectives. One, what I call narrow considerations. So to look at it from a very narrow perspective, which would be to look at the direct fiscal costs and fiscal return from the state's perspective. So a very narrow definition of looking at what's the revenue that's come in and what are the costs of implementing the policy directly to the Department of Revenue. And so if you look on the table, you can see these are the data from the 2014 returns that have come in. And keep in mind that there's a long lag as we get those corporate returns. So the first year this applied was the 2014 tax year. You can see that we have $28.4 million that has come in thus far. And you saw the $13.9 million on the DOR's biennial report. That was the amount that was reported voluntarily that was put on the return. You also have an additional $14.5 million that is the result of audits. So if you add those two together, it's $28.4 million. Some of the audits are ongoing as well. I also ask the department to show the jurisdictions in which income is reported from, and you can see that the largest is from Luxembourg. Luxembourg is $12.2 million. A high proportion of that is in audit. In fact, of the 12.2, $3.8 million was reported voluntarily. The rest is through audit. Yes.
Can you clarify what that means? Does that mean that the company filed a lawsuit?
Mr. Chair, no. It just means that the Department of Revenue has audited those returns and said, we think you have additional tax that you owe. And then so you open that discussion or dialogue with that corporate return. Potentially, it could lead to court challenges. Mm-hmm. And I've listed that in the report. That's obviously a risk going forward, that there will be court challenges to some of this revenue that's come in. And that would do two things. One, it would put the revenue at risk over time. And secondly, it would increase implementation costs to the Department of Revenue.
Which number gets figured into the forecast, the 28 or the 14?
Well, Mr. Chair, the one of the history is always changing too in the revenue world, because if you have a change resulting from an audit, you could get additional revenue or additional or a refund that goes back from what you thought was a collection. So that number is always changing a little bit. Our forecast for the first fiscal year, 14-15, was $20 million. So we, if you look at just from the 14 tax year, what we've seen so far, the $28.4 million, I think it's assuming that even if just half of those audited dollars materialize, then you would be over the $20 million. So it looks like we're going to be a little over the $20 million, but again, there's some risk there.
Senator Riley.
Thank you. So what I heard you just say, I think, is that neither the 14 or the 28, it's the number of dollars that actually come in the door. Is that correct?
That's correct, Senator Riley. The forecast that you see, that you base your budget on, is a cash forecast. So the amount that voluntarily has come in, they know that is in through the return. But what we're looking at is the return itself rather than the stream of payments coming in. So there's a different timing on between the two. The dollars that are audited may come in later, but if the audit is complete, and then oftentimes what you'll see is if a corporation is audited and assessed a certain amount, they'll pay it, and then they may challenge it later. Mm-hmm. And that way they've covered themselves for penalties, for example. So you can see Luxembourg, and then the second largest is Bermuda. The rest of the countries are the amounts are too small to report individually because of the disclosure laws you're familiar with. And then there are some dollars that came in which couldn't be traced back to a specific jurisdiction. The interesting thing about the top two jurisdictions, Luxembourg and Bermuda, they account for over 50% of the revenue that's come in, and they're also over 50% for Montana. We based our estimates on Montana, which we thought was the only data we had, but it's interesting that the same two jurisdictions are also the same that were the largest in Montana. So, if the other aspect of this, so what is the cost, direct cost to the Department of Revenue? Well, they went through and gave me some very detailed reports on those cost estimates, and thanks to Jeff Henderson for putting that together for us. Reporting costs were about $78,000. There's more in the first year, as you suspect, when they first start the process. It was $55,000, then $23,000 the second year. We would assume over time those would probably grow with inflation from that second year base. But the main cost is the audit cases. They've identified 115 audit cases, and they have an average of about 25 hours per case. So if you look at that, do the multiplication, it's $152,000 for the 2014 returns. So we suspect that would be a cost going forward, at least the next few years. But over time, if the policy is established, familiarity with it, that should come down. The risk, of course, is that we start to get into some issues that are in dispute and then potentially into court cases. And that's where you've got, of course, litigation with the potential to drive up those costs significantly. And that's the risk as we look ahead. So again, from a narrow standpoint, I think you can argue that the state, from a fiscal position, that it has been cost effective. The returns, the revenue that's come in has far exceeded what the initial implementation costs are. The second thing we looked at, and of course you spent a lot of your time thinking about these broader kinds of policy issues, and this is mostly what you've heard, I think, in terms of criticism of the policy. You have some testimony today from Council of State Taxation, for example, and the Organization of Foreign Organization for International Investment has pointed to some broader kinds of concerns. What we did here was try to list the benefits of the policy. based on the input we've had and kind of your discussions around it. I think the first thing is the state did make the decision in 2013 to go with the Montana model, which lists those jurisdictions, puts them in statute. The biggest advantage of that is the simplicity of it, that it's clear that if you have income reported in one of these jurisdictions, you got to report it. So in that way, there's no ambiguity about it. And then you have the department making those periodic recommendations based on their assessment of the criteria. The other benefits, an issue that a driving force behind this, I think, is the perspective that federal corporate tax policy has failed, that the federal government does not have a system set up that can give you an accurate tax base or an accurate water's edge number to start from. So Oregon and a number of other states have looked into this and have enacted legislation to try to get at a more accurate reflection of what the true water's edge income should be. To kind of look at it in a process-wise in terms of the federalist system, it's an example of the states getting out ahead of the federal government and experimenting with things to see what works. In terms of the other two benefits, you could argue that certainly by including the income that's not reported on the federal tax return, you've got a more accurate estimate of what the amount apportioned back to the state should be, and you have a better sense of equity on how taxes are divided among corporations themselves. And finally, an issue you've talked a lot about in a different context about the narrowness of the corporate base, this policy actually broadens the base. Now, in terms of the costs, the ones that I think you've heard and we've been documented in the material given to the committee, a lot of criticism around the idea of having specific jurisdictions listed. It's referred to by opponents as a blacklist and seen as a too simple of an approach to a highly complex question of taxation. So it's a blunt tool used in a situation that's probably going to give you some indirect or some inaccurate information income reported for individual returns. Another common criticism is that by listing these specific countries, that the states are venturing into foreign policy and what they should be, which is really the purview of the federal government, and the risk is to essentially to antagonize allies and trading partners, and you've heard some of that. You can also argue that the state and the Economic Development Department has continually emphasized international trade, foreign direct investment in the state, and I think you'll hear testimony that this is inconsistent with that. Finally, the legislature has been criticized by the Organization for International Investment, and you'll hear them today. They have some testimony in OLIS for you. So the bottom line in these kind of broader costs and benefits, I mean, they're obviously important ones and ones you need to keep in mind, but they're not ones that we can assign dollars to and say that there's X dollars cost versus benefits, but they're things to keep in mind. Finally, the appendix shows you what the listed jurisdictions are under current law, and then those that have been recommended. Panama was from the original Montana list and was excluded in 2015 or 2013. And then the department recommended a number of jurisdictions in 2015, three of whom were not ultimately added to the list by the legislature. That's Hong Kong, Netherlands, and Switzerland. And then the report you heard at the beginning of the session, the 2017 report, the additional jurisdictions recommended are Ireland, Jordan, Lebanon, Macau, and the United Arab Emirates. So those are the recommendations that came from the Department of Revenue. So that's our report, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Paul. I still believe that we should visit some of these tax havens to get a full feel for what's happening in Bermuda and Antigua and some of those places.
The list is right here, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
There's several you don't want to visit. I've been there.
Yeah. Senator Bertschinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, I'm worried about two things. So I've got two questions. One is, couldn't we just get in a shell game with, as we go down the road, that these corporations just start going to this country, you know, just it's a shell game? Mm-hmm. That's the first question. And the second mm-hmm. question is, the other shell game is, can't the corporations just go to other states in the union and move it over there? In other words, it just all becomes a shell game after a while.
Mm-hmm. Senator, you're right. I mean, the concern, or the broader concern, is, as you recall, it gets around what's called BEPS, which is the base erosion profit shifting, and that's what the OECD has been looking into, and has had a number of important strides in trying to get, you know, what you really are trying to do is have where the income is reported matching up where it's actually generated or earned. So you've got that, a consistent way to do that. And of course, we do that in the U.S. through our apportionment formulas. So we take that water's edge amount, and then we've got our apportionment formula, and that's, you know, your policy decision, and that should give you at least a way of apportioning back. At the international level, you don't have something like that that's operational. And if something like that were, it probably would lead to a lot more equitable distribution, and you'd be able to capture most of the corporate income that way in one of the jurisdictions. But I think it's going to be difficult at the international level because, you know, it's highly decentralized. There's not, you know, you have to have cooperation among the nation states and that's a big challenge. At the state level, there are a number of states that are considered tax havens in a lot of ways. For the corporate, I think you deal with it through the apportionment, but for individual taxes, you actually hear that more. For individual taxpayers, there are places like Nevada, for example, where they're suspected that a lot of income ends up being reported. And of course, there's always an incentive from a standpoint of any taxpayer to report it where the lowest tax rates are. And again, as I said a couple times in the report, and I know Department of Revenue has told you this too, I mean, the taxpayers are not doing anything illegal. They are, you know, they're responding with a tax strategy based on the laws that are out there. So it's not that they're doing something illegal.
Thank you.
Senator Boakes, you have a question about the Isle of Man.
Close. I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, first the simple question. And that is if we went to a VAT, a CAT, or a B&O, what happens to this whole scheme?
Okay. Mr. Vice Chair, if you were to go to something like Ohio's CAT, you would just be having all sales or all receipts that were generated from sales within Oregon would be the base. So there wouldn't be any apportionment. So you wouldn't take that step as you do with corporate income. You take the step of trying to determine what's the total amount of income, and then you apportion it. If you were to have a gross receipts privilege type tax like Ohio's, then it would just be based on the sales in the state. There would be no apportioning that would take place. So this issue wouldn't be an issue in that system.
To follow up, so in simple terms, it would go away.
Yes.
Okay. Second question, Mr. Chair. Paul, if you scroll up on your sheet there, and you have the jurisdictions that are either bad people forecasted by the Department of Revenue or the ones we've ignored because they're bad people, that particular list, just refresh my memory. I believe there's five to seven. Criteria, and of course the way we wrote the laws is if you just hit one of those five or seven and you're on the bad person list suddenly. And of course the reality is some of those on there we chose not to because they only meet one of the criteria. And there's some in that mm-hmm. thing, including the U.S. Virgin Islands, which is one of the biggest tax havens around, and it's in the United States, sort of like Nevada and Wyoming, is that some of them have three or four, but there's five or seven criteria in the statute. Mm-hmm. Says, you know, if you meet one, then DOR must recommend to us that it's one of these. Isn't that correct?
Yes, Senator. The way it works is the first criteria is that it's a zero or a very low effective tax rate, and one of five criteria are met. And that's, if you think back on that report, that's what the basis for the department's recommendations to add to the list. And in this particular version, a lot of them were around the third criteria, which has to do with the stateless entity issue. And that's where you see that most came up with the recommendations from this round. The criteria themselves are based on the Mobile State Tax Commission and the work that they did. So they're taken directly from those. Other states use them. We have states, some states that have gone the direction we have, but also a group of states that have enacted those criteria, but then haven't listed jurisdictions. And you'll hear some proposals to go more in that direction to eliminate the list itself and give more general criteria and have the Department of Revenue enforce that.
Sure. Thank you. Do we have an updated list of what Montana does?
I don't believe that Montana has any changes since 2013. They've recommended some additional, they've kind of gone through a cycle like we have gone through, where there's been some additional recommendations, but the legislature has not enacted them.
Okay. Well, thanks for that complete report. Okay. So let's move to our public hearing on 155. I'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 155. Paul, are you prepared to give us a briefing on the bill?
So, Mr. Chair, what we have done since you enacted the list of jurisdiction policy in 2013 is have asked council to introduce a bill with a right relating clause, and that's the role of Senate Bill 155. We have, just to as a starting point, have Guatemala removed, but that's not a policy recommendation.
Okay.
If this is your vehicle for any changes you want to make to the list, look at the department, what their recommendations are, so that could be put into this bill if that's the desire of the committee.
All right, relating to tax reporting of multinational corporations.
So, question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist.
Just to make sure, so Guatemala has not become a good person. It has. It's still recommended to be on the list. Is that what you're telling us?
Mr. Vice Chair, Guatemala still meets the criteria.
Yes. Okay, got it. They were jumping for joy down there, I thought.
We do have some people here. Brian Doherty, can you bring your team up?
Good morning, Chair Haas, members of the committee. I've asked your committee assistant to make sure he uses most of the buttons, so I touch as few buttons as possible today. I'm going to let introduce yourself. We have Philip Grant, the General Counsel for Ireland and the Western United States, and my tax partner, Ryan Nissel, who can answer any questions you have of me, hopefully, and we'll kind of present in this order. We have some slides here that hopefully I don't mess up by hitting any wrong buttons.
Good morning, Chairman, committee members. Thanks for bringing me to Salem for St. Patrick's Day. It's a great pleasure to be in Oregon.
Like that.
The Ides of March.
The Ides of March.
And you're in the Senate, by the way.
And I'm the Senate, indeed. I should watch out. Committee Chairman, members, Ireland is not a listed jurisdiction in Montana or any of the other states where similar measures to the Oregon legislation apply. Fortunately, this is the first time that we have been involved in a process of this nature, and it has been as much an education for me on the intricacies of the Oregon tax code as it has been about the Irish tax code and the relationship between the two. We've been very open in this process from the start, and you will have studied the comprehensive replies which Ambassador Anderson provided first to the Department of Revenue and latterly to you and Representative Bernhardt as chairs of the relevant committees here in Salem. And I'm happy to clarify any of the points that the ambassador set out in those letters. It's my responsibility to give you an overview of the Irish perspective on this particular issue. I want to say from the outset that this is not about Irish law offering a loophole to multinational corporations and then trying to close a loophole narrowly or phase it out over time. This is about Ireland fixing two separate problems due to mismatches between Irish and US law. And the reality is that where we discovered those mismatches, Ireland has acted unilaterally to put legislation in place. We have done and implemented what the drafters of this legislation intended. The United States and Ireland have separate, long-standing approaches to corporate tax residence. And in this case, it is the United States, not Ireland, that is the further distance from the global norm. In 2012, US Senate hearings made clear that a mismatch over corporate residency rules was being abused by aggressive tax planners to create a stateless company by being incorporated in Ireland, yet managed and controlled in the United States. This was a clear anomaly. Ireland acted unilaterally to shut that down in 2013. Legislation was targeted at this identified problem and solved it. It then emerged that a different aggressive structure was designed by multinationals and used to exploit weaknesses in US subpart F anti-avoidance rules. One part of this structure relied on the ability of a company to be incorporated in Ireland but not tax resident in Ireland, and used that fact to exploit a gap in US rules. Ireland acted again unilaterally in 2014 to change our residence rules to shut down this mismatch, subject to a transition period. The sole technical issue at stake here is the sunset or legacy clause, which was contained in the Irish legislation, which allowed for companies to wind down these arrangements. These are standard features when significant changes are made in tax processes. That is the only element that the Department of Revenue has found could bring Ireland under the scope of the Oregon legislation. But the reality is that Ireland has acted in the spirit of the law. We have changed our processes. We have done so unilaterally. We work at an international level to try and ensure that these anomalies and mismatches are closed. So far, unfortunately, the steps we have taken have all been on our side of the equation. But we deeply value the economic relationship that we enjoy with the United States. It would be remiss of me on the day before St. Patrick's Day not to mention that the single largest economic benefit that our two countries have provided to each other has been our people. For most of the history, Ireland's largest export to the United States was its people. It's because of those people that those American companies came to Ireland in the early 1980s. It's not because of our tax code. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Haas and the rest of the committee, I wanted to just emphasize a couple of things that Philip mentioned, and one is that this isn't an issue of a problem with Ireland. Ireland isn't a traditional tax haven country that has a low or nominal effective rate. In fact, Ireland's stated tax rate is 12.5%, which the Department of Revenue has
acknowledged. Could you begin with your name and where you're from?
Sure. Ryan, this is Ryan Nissel with Miller, Nash, Graham & Dunn.
I told him to do that. But
I apologize.
Only dog paddle.
It's not a traditional tax haven country that has a lower nominal rate. In fact, the Department of Revenue has acknowledged that the 12.5% corporate rate in Ireland is not nominal or zero. And in fact, Ireland taxes all of its all economic activity in Ireland, and unlike other countries, has a broad base. So although its stated rate may be slightly lower than other countries, its effective rate tends to be higher because of its broader base. And the problem that's created is this mismatch between traditional Irish taxing scheme, which actually comes from the UK and has been around for more than 70 years, and the US system. And as Philip mentioned, the Ireland's attempted twice to sort of fix this issue that's really a U.S. tax issue, and in doing so has knocked out most of the situations that could be characterized as a tax haven, including the 2013 Act that wiped out the arrangement with respect to all the treaty companies, including the U.S. And then the 2014 legislation sort of captured the rest, anything that was formed after 2014, and then the sunset period that ends in 2020. And this transition or sunset period is pretty standard for major tax law changes. When you have companies that have been doing business in Ireland for decades, and you're going to significantly change their tax structure, and so there's a transition period. The same thing that the federal government did when it imposes new taxes, such as the Affordable Care Act, or even Oregon has when it's made significant changes, like moving to 100% sales factor was phased in over time, and this is a very similar transition period, is all that it is. And the department, I think, has acknowledged that, but for that transition period, Ireland shouldn't be on the list at all, and they shouldn't necessarily be punished because they've taken all of these steps just subject to this transition period for a few years.
Chair Hass, members of the committee, Brian Doherty with the Miller Nash Graham and Dunn Law Firm, and I'm here representing the Republic of Ireland in this. If we could go to the statute, last page, I believe. What I'm going to talk about is the very statute that Senator Boquist was talking about. This is the two-step process to deal with. It's on down. About two more pages. Keep going. There we go. So ORS 317.717 is what I call a present tense statute. As you know, the Department of Revenue reports every 2 years to the revenue committees. In this last year, 2016, you got the report from the Department of Revenue recommending Ireland, among others. This, as I call it, present tense, because if you look at the bottom, and this highlighting is mine, of course, the department shall determine whether a jurisdiction is one that for the tax year, so every 2 years that tax year changes, this would naturally be 2016, has no or nominal effective tax on relevant income, and for which one of the following applies. Ireland was named under number 3. Keep in mind that for the effective tax year, we're looking at this as, and Ireland doesn't have a nominal tax, but what the Department of Revenue is saying, and by the way, we have very little disagreement with the Department of Revenue. We've met with them many times. They've been very helpful. Jeff Henderson and I have met. Ryan, we've all met with them. It is this transition period that allows some company, a small subset of companies that weren't eliminated in the 2014 and 2013 laws, to have a transition before they are going to have to meet Ireland's tax structure. So look at number 3. The jurisdiction, that's Ireland, facilitates the establishment of foreign-owned entities. Essentially, the rest is with stateless, in a stateless situation. That means in 2016, does Ireland facilitate the establishment of foreign-owned entities? It does not. You cannot come into Ireland and establish yourself in 2016 and enjoy this. It is the companies that had incorporated in Ireland prior to January 1, 2015, that subset of companies are the only ones that have this transition period. So I believe that this statute doesn't apply to Ireland, and I think it's appropriate to look at this in present tense. You're coming back, the Department is coming back and saying, what are these countries doing this year, this period? What have they done to do this? Ireland has taken a number of steps. After the 2014 agreement, they're a member, one of the only ones, there's only one other listed jurisdiction that is a member of the OECD and is implementing the BEPS, the base erosion profit sharing, which is the key to disclosure, transparency, and getting everybody off this. Ireland's the only one that's in there other than Luxembourg. And I think we're asking you to consider this. You're weighing the transition period where some companies are still in that with what Ireland's done that I think you should be encouraging in this situation, saying they've taken all the steps necessary to do this. They enacted a transition period. As you heard, it's been a common tax practice. So with that, we just ask that you not list Ireland in this session. Thank you very much for the time you've given us. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Thank you, and especially you, Mr. Grant, for coming up here. Your summation was very clear and compelling, and I think everybody knows how we all got here, Oregon and Montana, and the, you know, the issues faced by states with narrowing corporate tax bases and aggressive tax planning. I mean, everybody knows how everybody got here, so we appreciate you coming up here for your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Senator Brooklist. I just want to thank Ireland for actually implementing the tax laws that they have, which bring them in compliance, no different than, as they pointed out, the Affordable Care Act, and no different than we're discussing with whether we go to a CAT or a B&O, that there'll be a 2 or 3 year implementation period that goes out there. So
that's right. Senator Riley.
So I just wanted to echo that, and Slan, and thank you for coming in. Thank you for putting in the measures that you have, and we'll be looking at this again, I'm sure. And thank you again.
Thank you. Okay, Evan Hoffman and Nikki Bay.
Good morning, Chairman Haas, members of the committee. My name is Nikki Dobay. I'm here today on behalf of the Council on State Taxation in opposition of Senate Bill 155. Thank you for having me here this morning. As most of you know, COST is a nonprofit trade association representing approximately 600 members that do business in multiple jurisdictions. And our objective is to promote and preserve the equitable and non-discriminatory state and local taxation of multi-jurisdictional businesses. So why are we here today to oppose a bill where you're trying to remove a nation from the blacklist? COST has a long history of opposing tax haven legislation. And we think the blacklist is the worst of the worst. A little bit of history and
not quite so close to the microphone.
Okay. A little bit of history on tax haven legislation and where we're at since Oregon has adopted theirs. COST tracks this very regularly. So we have 7 states that impose some sort of tax haven legislation. There are 2 states, Oregon and Montana, that impose a list. Montana's list has not been updated since I believe it was adopted in 2005. It does still contain the Netherlands Antilles, which you took off the list in 2015 because it no longer existed. All the other states use a criteria approach. So Oregon and Montana are outliers. And there's a very small number of states that have imposed tax haven legislation at all. In the last 2 years, no states have adopted tax haven legislation. It's been introduced in several states. However, it's not been adopted. The other thing that's been happening with tax haven legislation is that states are realizing that it is out of step with the overall global approach to this issue, and there is an issue. Nobody's saying that there's not a base erosion issue. However, tax haven legislation is not in line with the overall approach, and it's falling out of favor with the states. We see a move away from that. So we see blacklisting of specific jurisdictions as overbroad, arbitrary, and misleading. It's a blunt tool, as Paul has said. When you look at how our statute is written, it doesn't matter what the entity is doing in that jurisdiction. If it's incorporated there, the income has to be brought into the return. So there's no look at the business activity within the state and what's happening. So we also know that this list was developed over 15 years ago by the OECD. The OECD no longer maintains the list. Again, Montana's no longer maintaining their list. So Oregon is a on an island here. It's maintaining a list. It's a very tough job. Folks don't really know how to do it now. The OECD has moved to the BEPS project. They're going in a different direction. And after looking at this problem and putting out almost 15,000 pages of analysis, tax havens, the listing of jurisdictions in this manner is not in any of those pages of analysis. So we would just remind Oregon that this is not the way the rest of the country is moving. This is not the way the rest of the world is moving on this issue, and you're continuing to go down a road and on your own. This is also a slippery slope back to a country-by-country worldwide reporting. Oregon has a long history with the Water's Edge election. You have very strong Water's Edge provisions, except for these. And this is really taking us back to a place where in the 1970s, this was the norm, worldwide reporting. By 1985, a global tax war had nearly erupted over worldwide reporting, with the UK adopting a retaliatory statute, which would have imposed sanctions against U.S. companies doing business in states with Water's Edge reporting, worldwide reporting. So we really see this as a return to that. And then finally, I would note that this is a very constitutionally suspect piece of legislation. As Paul mentioned, there are risks of litigation. We've seen the department aggressively auditing this issue. I hear from members at least once a week on this issue. And while there are a lot of dollars out there that they're seeking on audit, those dollars will not be voluntarily remitted. They are very likely to be subject to litigation and challenge, and I think we see that bubbling up now. So I think that is coming in the future. And so I don't think we're going to see those dollars coming in the door as easily as perhaps the department would like. So again, there's no doubt that there is a problem. There's base erosion and profit shifting. It's not because of things that are happening in Oregon. It's for other reasons, and this is really not the answer to that. So thank you again, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Chairman Haas and distinguished members of this committee, I am Evan Hoffman. I'm with the Organization for International Investment, or OFI. I'm pleased to have the opportunity to testify today on this important issue, which we feel relates to Oregon's economic global competitiveness. Like COST, OFI also strongly opposes the tax haven blacklist approach because we feel it acts as a clear barrier to attracting foreign direct investment. Rather than consider legislation that would continue this policy, we would urge the committee to think through alternative paths that would achieve your same goal to prevent the tax motivation or tax avoidance, to prevent income shifting, but which also don't have all the unwanted policy consequences, some of which Paul mentioned earlier in his presentation. So OFI, as the only business association that represents the U.S. subsidiaries of foreign headquartered companies, our mission is to ensure that the United States remains the most attractive destination in the world to attract global companies to invest and create jobs here. Our member companies include many of Oregon's most important employers, companies like TE Connectivity, Genentech, Daimler, Garmin, Siemens, ExxonMobil, to name a few. We work very closely with groups like Business Oregon, the Oregon Economic Development Association, Greater Portland, Inc., and other economic developers across the state on our joint goal of trying to attract global companies to invest in Oregon and create jobs. In fact, I was here a few months ago, last session, and had the opportunity to testify before the Senate Business and Transportation Committee and the House Economic Development Committee on steps and strategies that the legislature can consider in attracting additional foreign direct investment. If you ask any economic developer, they will tell you that foreign direct investment means good-paying jobs for Oregon workers and communities. These companies deliberately choose to invest in the United States compared to all other global locations in the world. They employ 6.4 million U.S. workers. It's about 52,000 jobs in Oregon. That's about a little more than 5% of the country's private sector workforce is attributed to foreign direct investment. And these companies really do punch above their weight. They choose the U.S. to locate high-value economic activities here. To give you a couple more statistics, they employ about 20% of the U.S. manufacturing workforce, fund 17% of U.S. research and development activities, and they actually account for 26% of U.S. exports. So with that background about the importance of foreign investment, I'll just offer a few more comments about why our member companies are concerned with the tax haven blacklist approach. Kind of as Nikki alluded to, if the tax policy goal is to use it as a tool to address corporate tax avoidance, if this is truly the legislature's goal, then the policy fails because it taxes any business that is incorporated in a deemed tax haven, including those companies that operate legitimately with real business purpose. All transactions, including those which are globally recognized as arm's length, which have no tax avoidance purpose, are caught by this policy. So therefore, the blacklist as written fails to distinguish between these companies that operate legitimately in these jurisdictions from those using the country as a tax shelter. And this approach has a real consequence for foreign investment attraction, and I'll give you a clear example. So imagine tomorrow a company grows organically in a country that is on Oregon's tax haven list. This company succeeds locally and wants to invest in the United States to access our incredible market and our talented workforce. It wants to build a new distribution warehouse. It wants to hire sales executives. It wants to build a manufacturing site. Would the company choose Oregon when it would be subject to discriminatory taxation because its home country happens to be on Oregon's blacklist? It might choose Oregon, as tax, as we all know, is only one consideration in an investment calculation. But being subject to additional taxation, unlike other states, because it operates in a listed country, doesn't help Oregon's case. And then two more quick concerns. I'll say that if the goal is to target abusive transactions, then we would actually argue the blacklist falls short of this because the blacklist does not capture any abusive activity that may be occurring in countries which aren't on the list. In addition, we think the blacklist approach is inflexible and can't stand the test of time. You can see a situation where a country may change their international tax approach to align with international tax norms, but the committee has to look at this issue every 2 years, and so therefore it may be taxing a jurisdiction which really isn't a tax haven. And last, kind of what Paul said, the issue of labeling our allies, trading partners, as tax havens is a very real concern that we appreciate this committee considering. Like Nikki mentioned, other states have taken other approaches. We would really urge the committee to go in these directions. Rhode Island and Connecticut, the last two states to enact tax haven policy since Oregon in 2013, chose the criteria approach over the blacklist approach. They also included exemptions that would prevent the taxation of arm's length transactions, those legitimate business transactions that aren't undertaken with the purpose of tax avoidance. And they also built in clear tax treaty protections. All the other comments that I had have been said already. We really appreciate the gravity of the consequences within this policy. And that's why we're here today. We're happy to be a resource to the committee as you guys consider your international tax approach. Thank you.
Thank you both. As was noted here before, if Oregon swaps out its corporate income tax for a commercial activity tax, then the tax havens go away. It's no more tax havens, no more blacklists. I gather you, assuming the rates are in line with other states, you would support that swap.
Costs cannot support a gross receipts tax, so we would not be in favor of that, but we would be in favor of the tax haven legislation going away.
For AFI, our tax principles are built on a few ideals, and so as long as tax policy is non-discriminatory, that is, it doesn't treat U.S. companies different than the U.S. subsidiaries of global companies which are investing in the United States, we are also looking for tax policy to align with international tax norms. We want the policy not to violate the principles of bilateral tax treaties, which our country negotiates with our trading partners. So those are the types of things we'd be looking at in the gross receipts tax.
Thank you. And I admit that part of that was a trick question. but it is, you know, I know you do appreciate the dilemma that all states like Oregon are in with a narrowing corporate income tax base, with research now saying it's the corporate income tax that Oregon and 40 other states have is becoming more obsolete. And so given that reality, Montana, Oregon, other states are looking at different ways to keep schools open and state police on the road and all of those things.
Senator, or Chairman, can I add something to that?
Sure.
Oregon has tools to address this issue. We have add-back tools. We have Section 482 powers, which allow the department to go in and look at things on a transaction-by-transaction basis. So Oregon already has the tools to really address these types of situations. It's a little tougher. It requires a bit more digging into the facts and figuring out who the bad actors are. But those tools all exist. So they're out there, and we would represent that, yes, this is a blunt approach, which maybe makes it easier on one hand, but you're really opening yourselves up to some litigation risks. And, I don't think anybody wants to see Oregon as the poster child for tax haven legislation being found unconstitutional.
And I'll add, other states that have looked at addressing income shifting concerns have chosen policies, and most of these policies, whether it's an add-back requirement or combined reporting, or even Connecticut and Rhode Island in their own tax haven criteria approaches, are recognizing that it's important to distinguish between what is that abusive tax activity that we're trying to target and those legitimate business transactions undertaken without a principal purpose of avoiding tax. And so you see dozens and dozens of states add clear tax treaty exemptions. They're adding clear exemptions for that income, those transactions which are arm's length and widely recognized as arm's length. So these are important considerations that aren't in Oregon's blacklist approach, and we would urge the committee to think through some of these additional questions.
No, I think I better keep my mouth shut. If you want to sue us, please feel free.
Yeah, exactly.
And don't threaten us again.
Okay. Thank you. We have no one else signed up here, and any business before us? We have no committee tomorrow.
Committee meeting is Monday, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Adjourn till Monday, 8:30. Thank you. 8:30. Thank you.